Well, okay, I guess we can maybe just get going, and if people come late, they will figure out what we're talking about. So, hi, I am Rebecca Lieber. I'm a reporter at Vox. I'm also a SEJ board member, and really excited for this discussion today because this gas in buildings has been a passion project of mine for a few years now. So I thought we would start out by just sharing my own story of how I kind of came into this issue, because I think this has maybe, it's exploded recently, but there's been a lot going on for years. So I guess for the folks we have here now, I was hoping maybe by a show of hands, I'm curious how, like, if folks in the room were aware of the research or any research around gas stove pollution before, like, let's say January of this year. We have a very knowledgeable crowd. So, one more question. I'm curious if you can remember whether you were aware of, like, or ever kind of thought about gas stove pollution, maybe before, like, let's say 2020. Show of hands. So a few. Okay. So I think this shows how much this issue has just exploded, and there's kind of awareness around gas throughout our supply chain, throughout our consumption, how much this issue is changing, and I hope you leave today realizing how much is also ahead, how much more there is to dig into and report on here. So I viewed gas stoves as this entry point for covering the politics and policy of building electrification. There's a lot going on here with on health research, but also climate research of the ways methane leaks throughout the gas supply chain contribute to climate change. Buildings also just have a large greenhouse gas footprint. They contribute about 12% of our U.S. greenhouse gas emissions and are a large percentage of our energy and electricity consumption. So gas stoves are an example of the way that gas is used in buildings, but we also have them for furnaces and water heaters. And this is just, and also some people have laundry machines that are powered by gas. So before we jump into the content here, just wanted to share briefly how I got into gas stove reporting, which was around 2020, early kind of pandemic, when a source, and probably also Sage over here, started talking to me about influencers, gas stove influencers, and that was something that just grabbed me instantly, because my first question was, why are there gas stove influencers? Like, why would this exist in the world? So there were a series of ads on Instagram by influencers who were hired by various trade groups connected to the gas industry promoting cooking with gas. And from there, I think that's where I worked backwards of why this existed, why would the gas industry care enough to hire influencers, and if they care enough to hire influencers, what's going on? What's the actual fight underneath this? So from there, just more and more questions emerge as I dug into this. And just to give you an example of how kind of deep this goes and long this storyline is, the story I did was about Instagram influencers, but there's actually some really fun examples throughout the decades that I'm going to just pull up and play, like, the briefest clip, if I can get that. Let me see if I can just, is it still in there? Okay. So some examples of that, there's gas ads through the 30s and 40s and 50s, but this is just, I'll play a brief clip of an 80s style rap.
Cooking with gas.
Cooking with gas.
We all cook better than cooking with gas.
Gas is so hot, it's not off, and it's off. It's the only way to cook. That's what I was taught. Here's a fact you should have to know the facts. Now, You should cook with gas.
Okay, I think you get that. So I think, like, discovering this, it's like, how is there not a fascinating story underneath all this? So we're going to dig into the science and the policy here on gas in buildings and how this is connected to indoor air quality and policy fights throughout the country. So I have on this panel probably some of the most knowledgeable people in the country on this. So I would love to just dig right into the content, so I'm going to do like very brief introductions here. But we have Darna Noor, who's recently at the Boston Globe covering a lot on gas stove research, but also building electrification and utilities kind of fighting around the future of gas. And then we have Adrian Underwood. So just a programming note, we had Drew originally coming, who's a scientist with PSE Healthy Energy, which is an independent research nonprofit. But Adrian was very gracious to come at last minute notice to fill his place. So I'm really glad to have her here today. And then Sage Welsh, who has worked on this issue from the beginning at a communications firm that works with a lot of the advocacy side around this issue, and I think just has this wealth of knowledge and probably knows more about stoves than anyone else. So, okay, I've done enough talking here, but I hope to kind of kick off with Sage laying some groundwork here that I think, like we kind of pulled in the beginning, the public definitely became maybe more aware of the science around gas and indoor air quality just this January when I think it was a mix of events, but the Consumer Product Safety Commission had a commissioner saying maybe they're looking at banning gas stoves. Since then, the agency has walked this back. They are not looking at banning gas stoves, but they are certainly looking at the health effects. So I hope you could kind of walk us to that moment of why, how did we get to a place where suddenly the Consumer Product Safety Commission was even looking at gas stoves and health?
Yeah, thanks, and thanks so much for having me. So scientists, regulators, and the gas industry themselves have been investigating the health risks of burning methane gas indoors for as long as this has been on the table. So as long as these appliances have been around and as long as gas service in homes has been a service that's available. One of the things that I absolutely love most, and it's hard to choose, about the 1980s rap, is that, like, if you listen closely, about half of that is like safety awareness. It's like, it's not on when it's off. Like, it's reminding you to turn it off. And I think there's like this implicit acknowledgement that, like, yes, chefs love it supposedly, but also it's dangerous. So the very fact that when you're cooking with gas, you're burning a fossil fuel, it produces a huge range of pollutants, and then also is a danger to life. Rebecca's own reporting, really interesting, has these, you unearthed some minutes from an industry meeting in 1907 where some gas industry folks are kind of debating ventilation for gas stoves and just acknowledging that simply by piping gas into the home, there is this risk of life, not to mention some of the byproducts and pollution that comes from the stoves. So certainly, like, over 100 years of information has been available and just strong debate on the topic. Interestingly, there were actually, ventilation was required if consumers requested it for gas stoves from the 1930s onward, is my understanding, and those requirements were dropped in the 1950s. And that was something that I think AGA and National, I forget the acronym, but standards body did require. In 1973, it was the first time that EPA scientists published the first study linking respiratory illness and NO2 exposure from stoves. So that's a good 50 years. And from there, the research has just grown. By my team's count, we have at least 57 peer-reviewed studies that link gas cooking to a range of health harms. The industry themselves certainly has conducted really extensive research into this going back to the early 1970s. The AGA had something called AGA Labs. They were doing really extensive research there.
AGA is American Gas Association.
The American Gas Association, yes. Another body, the Gas Research Institute, which became the Gas Tech Institute, which is still around. They were creating like test homes where they could really monitor the pollutants. And also the industry was really hard at work in the 1970s and 80s looking at alternatives. So there was acknowledgement essentially about NO2 pollution, nitrogen dioxides that were that come from the burning of gas. Industry was quite aware of this. They start working on different stove designs to lower that NO2 pollution. I've got two papers here if folks are interested. I think it's like very valuable airplane reading. One really delves into that stove that they're working on, which was an infrared stove. NPR did some reporting on this earlier this year. It basically would have cut the flame size down pretty considerably, and that would have lowered the NO2 pollution about 40%. What I think is incredibly interesting is that if you were to cut that NO2 pollution they found, you would increase the carbon monoxide pollution coming from the stove tenfold. And that's just like a heat-related issue. And so right now, while the Consumer Product Safety Commission is really engaged in this study of like, can gas stoves be made safe, I find it really interesting that if you're lowering the NO2, you're increasing the carbon monoxide, and carbon monoxide will kill you. Much more.
Yeah, we're going to get into.
Okay.
So there's more than nitrogen dioxide that is problematic here.
Certainly, yeah. Industry itself conducting extensive research. I have a paper here. It's written in 1984. It's called "The Impact of Indoor Air Quality on the Gas Industry." Not the other way around, but it's written by industry lawyers for industry lawyers. The reason I think this paper is so fascinating, it's like this really robust snapshot of how we were looking at this issue in the 70s and 80s. So in 1979, Congress had created an interagency research group on indoor air quality. That included folks from CPSC, EPA, and a number of other government bodies. And like going back to the 70s, people were getting really interested in like wellness, air quality. You know, we had like the Clean Air Act. We're just like kind of having this like growth in consciousness around air pollution indoors and outdoors. There was a focus on indoor air because we were also in the process of trying to figure out energy conservation. So we were really like tightening building envelopes. And folks were really aware that like the more we were tightening envelopes and the efficiency of buildings, we were kind of locking folks into the pollutants that were in their homes. So a bunch of different folks were researching this. I also think this paper is fascinating because the media was discussing it at the time as well. In 1981, there was like in Massachusetts an indoor air quality symposium, and no less than 15 scientific papers were presented at that conference strictly on fossil fuel appliances and air quality. So this idea that this is somehow new, and I know for the public, most people are like, what the hell happened in January when people started talking about the air quality?
How do we have something in our homes that has gone, how could it be unsafe because we've had it for so long? I think that is a bit of the reaction here.
Totally. I think I have it too. This assumption that like if something's bad for us, someone would have had to let us know. But I guess that's just kind of not the case in America.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is agencies have looked at this, but for one reason or other, or a lot of reasons, we haven't had regulation. And this goes back to indoor air quality being this kind of overlooked black box, that there's lots of gaps in our regulatory system looking at indoor air quality.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me that the closest we came to regulation was in the early 80s under the Reagan administration. The other reason I think this paper is really significant is you just see the industry amongst themselves really laying out the risks. And they were super worried right then about the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So they were really examining standards for like kerosene appliances and a number of other various appliances. And the industry is kind of like, and that's why they're working on presumably this other stove model, just knowing that regulations were likely imminent. And then EPA and CPSC in this whole period, as these government bodies are kind of debating how severe the problem is, if it's deemed, you know, severe enough to warrant regulations, what exactly they should do about it. EPA, CPSC at one point kind of asks EPA, is this a problem? Should we be doing something? That's in the early 80s. EPA responded in 1986 and said, yes, I mean, there's a number of different reasons why we think we should look at this. We think that y'all should really determine what is that level of NO2 that is coming off of the stove. So, like, let's determine the concentration, and then we can figure out if and how we can make this a bit safer. And then, of course, that's the mid-80s. What we see happening at that time is just budget cuts, industry pressure, a number of reasons
they didn't regulate.
Yeah.
But, if I can jump time a little bit, catching us up to the present, maybe briefly talk about what has come out in the last couple of years that has also changed this conversation, or at least brought this back into public awareness.
Yeah, so I think a couple different things have happened. One is that the sort of environmental and climate community, I think, there's been a resurgence of focus on the health issues as a part of a broader scrutiny that natural gas in general has come under as we've been, you know, shoring up our climate commitments and figuring out how we're going to get to carbon neutrality or decarbonizing all of our sectors by mid-century. And starting in 2019, we have cities beginning to look at ways that they can cut emissions. One of the biggest source of emissions under their jurisdiction is buildings. And so I think, well, we'd had this robust debate in the 70s and 80s. I think everyone kind of forgot about it for a long time. And it starts coming back into view. And I think even from the advocates' perspective, like you just mentioned, just like the public, I think everyone was like, oh, really? Like, there's also all of these health dangers. And so that brought it back into view. And then also the scientific research has really been growing from studies that have, no one ever stopped researching this. The research has been ongoing. And a number of studies have started coming out, really shoring up and doing like meta-analysis. What is the full impact? How much can we link sort of respiratory issues, heart issues, cognitive difficulties, and specifically asthma risk to this NO2 pollution coming off of stoves? And then in January is when a new study came out that took some of the risk factors that have been well established and just applied that to childhood asthma in the U.S. and found that close to 13% of childhood asthma can be attributed to gas stove use in this country. And the higher gas using states, New York, California, Illinois, those have even like topping 20% of childhood asthma that could actually be directly impacted.
Thanks for running through almost a century of research in a very short period, but this is a great segue for Adrian to talk about the work that PSC is doing, because I think gas stoves are a great jumping off point, but we're not just talking about the stove, we're talking about a infrastructure system that is, there's transportation, there's other parts of the home that we are combusting gas, and can you just talk through with PSC's work what we know and maybe don't know about the other hazardous pollutants that are potentially hitching a ride to the NO2 that Sage was talking about?
Yeah, so my name's Adrian Underwood. As Rebecca mentioned, I work at PSC Healthy Energy, and we're a nonprofit research institute based out of Oakland, California, but we have scientists based across the U.S. And the PSC in our name stands for Physicians, Scientists, and Engineers. We were founded by three researchers out of Cornell about 10 years ago. And at that time, we were focused on fracking, and they felt like there was kind of a gap in the peer-reviewed research on the impacts, you know, both to our climate, but also to public health and the environment. So kind of since our founding, we've been really looking at not just climate impacts, but also how do energy systems impact public health and, natural gas systems in particular. So we kind of came, that's kind of our origin story, and we came into this research, over time. So in 2021, we did a literature review looking at basically all the research that had been done on methane and hazardous air pollutants across the oil and gas stream, so everything from kind of where it's pulled out of the ground into our homes, and is Sage was giving a really good history, you know, from, there is a lot of research and it's pretty well established that burning natural gas in your home creates NO2, which is a respiratory irritant. Other hazardous air pollutants have been studied far less, and what we found also is that, you know, there is evidence at, you know, oil and gas wells where it's pulled up out of the ground, right, that natural gas, you know, it's mostly methane, but industry for many years has said it's mostly methane, but it's also, you know, trace amounts of other chemicals. And they're not required to report what those chemicals are. So there's a big question mark about what else is in natural gas. And that, so that became a really central research question for our organization, was just, let's answer this fundamental question, what's in natural gas? We know, because there's far more studies that have happened kind of at oil and gas wells at the production level, that at that stage, there are hazardous air pollutants in gas. So that's, you know, why states like California have passed laws, you know, requiring now for there to be a kilometer distance between a home and an oil and gas well, because there are birth defects, right? There are real issues with living close to those, right? And we know also that those exposure levels are potentially, you know, much higher than you might get in your home. But still, there's this open question, like, are we being exposed to other chemicals inside of our home in a space that has, you know, is confined with, you know, confined air exchange rate, right, which is all what we start to kind of worry about with public health, is like how often and how intensely are you exposed to the chemicals. So, as Sage was highlighting, you know, there's a lot of research that's looked at what happens when we turn the gas stove on, but there was basically no research looking at what happens if you're exposed to unburned natural gas. And so we have two researchers, Drew McCanowitz, whose plane got turned around halfway on the way here and was not able to join today, who was leading research out of Harvard Sea Change at the T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And he was testing homes all throughout the Boston region, looking at just going, you know, and putting, basically pulling samples of unburned gas, right? So not lighting it, just putting like a tube onto the burner and pulling out a bag of gas and sending it to a lab. So he was doing research out of Harvard, and then we had Eric LaBelle, who is at Stanford University. And he was doing a study out of the Woods Institute with Rob Jackson, and they were looking at, you know, do gas stoves leak? And the rate at which gas stoves leak. And so kind of around the same time in 2022, we had both of these studies come out. Both of them now work for us. So we've been, you know, bringing on researchers who are doing the leading research in this space. And so their research at that time, we kind of got these two new pieces of information. Yes, gas stoves leak. Eric LaBelle's study showed that basically of looking at gas stoves throughout the state of California, regardless of the make, the model, how old it was, right? Gas stoves leak small amounts of gas all the time around the clock, in addition to what happens when you turn your gas stove on and NO2 is created, right? So we now know that there's the potential to be exposed to unburned gas. And then Drew's study comes out with the answer to, okay, so what is in natural gas? He had looked in Boston, and those samples showed that there were over 21 different hazardous air pollutants in natural gas, right? And so now we're starting to paint a picture that there's at least the potential. This is called a hazard identification study inside like the research speak, right? We now know that there's the potential to be exposed to, you know, these hazardous air pollutants. An interesting piece that we saw in the California or in the Boston study was that actually, you know, they had taken it. The study was happening during COVID, so the study was happened over a longer period of time than we'd expected. And one of the interesting things that came out from it we hadn't expected until we looked was that actually concentrations of benzene, which we're particularly concerned about, right, because of its cancer-causing properties. And that it's, you know, it's an EPA regulated pollutant. This, you know, changed throughout the year. So actually concentrations were higher in the winter when you might expect people to be indoors with their windows closed, right? These are things that we just wouldn't know. That there's this big question about what's in gas. What is that? So that's kind of what we've been answering. And that takes us to our more recent California study, which then kind of put these two pieces of information together. We said, okay, we know there are hazardous air pollutants in gas. We're going to do the same thing. We're going to test throughout the state of California, look at what hazardous air pollutants are in gas in the state. Do we find the same things? We don't know if we will. And also, we're going to take the leakage rate data that we got from Eric's study and use that to model potential concentrations indoors. So we're getting closer to, like, are these happening in concentrations we might be concerned about for health? And the answer for that study was, again, yes, there is benzene in nearly all samples. We took 159 samples across the state. Concentrations were different, so actually concentrations in the Los Angeles area were higher than we saw in Northern California. You know, this raises a lot of questions about why that would be, which we don't have the answer to, but it's certainly, in houses we saw based on leakage rates, in houses, kind of, we look at this case where there's, higher leakage rates and a less well ventilated home, we saw rates that might be, on par with secondhand smoke in terms of benzene exposure. So really significant and concerning levels are possible. And again, I just want to say, that is kind of an edge case for leakage, but you have to remember these are small leaks that are undetectable by smell. You can reach the concentration of secondhand smoke in some edge cases just by doing that. That does not include any other A sources in your home or turning on or off of the stove. So
yeah,
that's kind of where
thanks
we are.
Thanks for that clarification.
Yeah.
When we're talking about heating and water heaters, there's a lot more gas involved than when we're talking about the
totally.
Stove. But the stove is and oven is in someone's kitchen, so it's you're interacting with that a lot more.
Yeah.
Darn, I wanted to bring you in here, and I guess we just got a really quick like crash course into the research and how things are evolving, and kind of just want to start from you're a journalist covering this issue. There is a lot of research in this body of literature that you have. There's also there's other research looking at how ventilation comes in, and ventilation being a really important piece to how much you're exposed. There's also problems with ventilation, like we all have very different types of ventilation.
Absolutely.
If we have it at all. So I hope you could talk a little bit about like how you're assessing the literature and like what are some of the challenges in reporting on some of this kind of competing information out there.
Yeah, it's a great question. As I think we sort of heard in Sage's kind of brilliant relaying of the past 100 years of regulatory policy, this is a question that's come up recently, but it's really one that regulators have been looking at for a very long time, right? This question of what the gas stove is doing to indoor air quality. In Boston and Massachusetts, I think this is a particularly relevant issue, not only because, so many people are using gas, the vast majority of homes in Boston are heated with gas and are, the cooking stoves and ovens are powered by gas as well, but also because there's such a vast sort of body of literature that's coming out of the institutions in Boston. And so that results in studies like the one that you just mentioned from PSE and Harvard Sea Change that showed that, Boston homes in particular, we're seeing high concentrations of benzene coming out of gas stoves, and research showing that in Massachusetts, the rate of childhood asthma, again, as you mentioned, is even higher than it is for the rest of the country. You know, 1 in 7 children in Massachusetts who have asthma may have that asthma because of their exposure to gas stoves. For context, that is the same as if children lived with a smoker in the home, if not higher, which is pretty incredible. But Massachusetts is an interesting place, I think, to look at the issue because it's in some ways sort of a leader on climate policies, and in other ways it's extremely beholden to gas interests. Massachusetts has one of the leading sort of energy efficiency policies in the country, the MassSave program. It produces lots and lots of kind of emissions cuts. It creates incentives for people to do things like buy induction stoves, switch over to heat pumps, things like this. But the regulatory agencies are not the ones who are controlling that program. It's actually run by the gas utilities. And so that means that right now you can still get incentives for switching over to gas appliances, even though this is supposed to be sort of a climate-friendly program. It's the state's best tool to bring emissions down for sort of homeowners and for businesses. So I think that really shows the tension that we're working with, wherein in some cases it's folks who are invested in a future that includes gas who are responsible for sort of creating a climate future that should be livable, but also is not giving our children asthma. And so I think this is it's a really important sort of local story because of, you know, the kids in their homes who are exposed every day because of the institutions that are producing the research, but also because the regulatory agencies, because the state agencies, because the local agencies that are responsible for taking care of the problem so often don't realize, I think, that that they are themselves working with those who have a material interest in the status quo.
Yeah, we're going to dig more into the policy and emerging storylines because I think there's this idea that maybe the an agency is looking at it and that's the end of the story, but there's so much activity happening in gas combustion indoors. It's been this long overlooked area. And before we kind of close out a look on the science part here, Adrian, I wanted to ask, what are the challenges in studying this? Like, why are researchers still looking at this issue if we've been studying this for decades? Why are there so many unanswered questions here?
Yeah, there's definitely, I think, several answers to that question. One of them, I would say, is, the reason, I think, which I kind of laid out, that there's even a research question here for PSCs because industry isn't required to report what's in natural gas. So it has meant that we're kind of doing like a door-to-door approach here to answer that question for ourselves. And so that's certainly a challenge. And it's a challenge from a scientific perspective because, when we collect a sample, we send it to the lab and we basically have to know how to ask them what to look for. I mean, they're going to pull like a panel of a certain amount of pollutants. So there's just I think there's a challenge on that end of making sure that like we have a lot of studies that point out NO2, but have they looked at everything else that comes out of combustion? Probably not. And that's partly because we just actually invested in some extremely expensive air quality analyzers, that you are large machines you track into people's homes, right? That's expensive equipment. It's hard to get your hands on, right? So there's that piece of it. I think there's also just the fact that indoor air quality itself is not regulated, and so that creates a challenge both from understanding what's an acceptable amount of exposure. There's all sorts of pollutants out in the world, right? We get exposed to benzene and all sorts of different chemicals, in lots of different ways. But to be able to not only understand what's appropriate, what's too much, but also communicate that publicly. It is made much more complicated by the fact that actually we haven't decided that as a society. We have been able to say things like we found, NO2 levels inside the home that would be illegal outdoors, right? But there isn't a framework to say actually what's allowable inside. And then finally, I would just say from a public health perspective, public health research is complicated. It's hard to prove causality, without any doubt. And so what we have to do, I think that take the case of natural gas, exposure and asthma, right? What the science is able to do at this point is look at, probability rates, essentially, right? And based on the research that we have, exposing young children to, establishing a dosage link, right? That the more they're dosed, the more likely they have asthma is not morally something we can do.
You can't run this natural, an experiment where you're
actually testing over time.
Putting kids in front of unvented gas machines.
Exactly. So, so I think that there are those challenges, and what that means is the way you kind of get at that without being able to check all the boxes you would need to just say definitively this causes that is to just build up this enormous body of research, which is what we're working on, right? So we're taking the studies that we've done in two states now and doing it across the United States. We're doing it internationally, to really say, do we keep getting this answer? Is it clear, increasingly clear that this is the case?
Can I just add one point to that I don't know is a barrier that I feel like is a human behavior barrier. One thing I think is so interesting about this is that it's already in 70 million homes in this country. And I feel like advocates have the discussion, I know that scientists have the discussion of we don't want to freak everyone out to the extent where we cause public panic, but we also feel an obligation to make sure that it is well known and discussed. And I just, part of me wonders how much, you know, we're not testing it indoors because it's not regulated. And I just know within the advocacy community, there is a real discussion about, like, how do we relay it without really worrying people, and how do we get to the regulatory point where we can do something about it that's empowering? And I don't know, that's just kind of a factor, I think, in how we think about this.
Yeah, so we're talking a lot about natural gas here, but Darna, I hope you could talk briefly about propane, which, let's see, I'm trying to remember the map of propane in the country. It's a smaller fuel source, but still significant. It's a big one in the Northeast, and yeah, I think there might be some confusion around these different sources, so I'd love you to talk about that specifically. Is it the same problem as gas?
Yeah, it's a good question. And just really briefly, you know, in reporting on propane stoves, I was kind of shocked to find that in many cases, people didn't really know what it is that their cooking appliances were running on. You know that there's gas, you know that there's a flame, and in many cases, people don't know exactly what that gas powering it is. Propane is different. There's some research that shows that in terms of indoor air quality, it's not as much of a problem as methane gas. But the research is really limited. You know, frankly, this is an issue that, because it's kind of only in certain pockets, because not as much of the country runs on propane, because not as much, not as many people use propane for cooking, for heating, etc. There's just not as much research on the air quality implications. There's also, I think, an interesting story here of the sort of frenemy relationship between the propane and gas lobbies, wherein, I think in some ways the propane industry has something to gain by sort of hitching its ride to electrification, saying, hey, we're a great backup fuel, we are really compatible with your climate plans that want to electrify homes, etc. In other ways, you know, obviously electrification is a threat to this industry, and so the relationship between these two sort of industries, the associations, the lobbyists, etc., and how they have gone rapidly, kind of oscillated between a sort of romance wherein they're both fighting electrification together, back to the propane industry lobbying for electrification, is, I think, really fascinating and something that's going to ramp up and change a lot over the next few years, especially as more and more cities take electrification seriously.
Yeah, on the propane note, I'm gonna get this wrong. They're called PERC for short. The propane lobby, essentially, they're hiring their own influencers.
Yes.
Yeah, so that issue hasn't gone away. The New York Times did a great story on PERC, I think a month or two back, and how they're hiring like HGTV actors to promote propane. I had a story go up about a month ago about a propane influencer who's this kind of celebrity influencer chef who's, I think, claim to fame is he's a divorcee of Leanne Rimes, but he's been going on local network television talking about how healthy propane is and good for the environment. So it's like going back to that tension that you were just talking about. Before we get into audience questions, I wanted to shift to policy because there's a lot of questions and emerging storylines on the science, but I think the policy front is even more fascinating because there's so much happening. So as I understand it, I think over 100 municipalities now are looking at their building codes to electrify, but this kind of like idea around how do we regulate gas indoors has been on so many different tracks. There's do we regulate this as a health and air quality issue? Do we regulate this as a climate issue and electrify buildings to get gas out of homes? So I hope you could kind of like give us just a bit of that landscape, what's happening in the country, and particularly what we're seeing happening right now.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so there's probably there's four bodies of policy. You've got the local level policy, which is what you just referenced. Right now we have over 100 local jurisdictions, 7 states that have passed some kind of either building code or municipal code ordinance that either restricts natural gas hookups in new construction or incentivizes or sort of requires all electric ready buildings. And by the time you make a building all electric ready, you should just use electric appliances in it because you've set it up and it's ready to go. And also electric appliances are better. But that is one level. That's really what kind of gave birth to this broader building electrification movement. Berkeley, California passed the nation's first standard in 2019. Berkeley did a combined model. So at first they just did this municipal code ordinance that restricts gas hookups. They later went back and altered their energy code. And I raise that because we just had a really important decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on this topic, which we'll get to. But you've got that local government action that has really pushed forward this issue. And to be honest, in a way that has surprised even the advocates that were encouraging this, it just kind of spread like wildfire. In less than 4 years, we now have like 1 in 5 Americans who live in a region that has a building decarbonization policy. And I think that's just like really dramatic and rapid growth of one climate issue that like wasn't even on the table in 2018. So local governments have really picked this up, ran with it. Their authority is totally mixed. So different states have different rules about what local governments can do. And then of course we have this issue of federal preemption that we'll get to. There's also state level policy. So a number of states also have their own state building codes. Washington State, for example, last year passed the nation's first building code that goes the furthest on electrification in that it requires heat pumps and heat pump hot water heaters as the base level tech for those buildings. California did a similar thing, and we're coming up to the point where we're working on our new building code update, so we'll see what the 2025 code does. But so there's also state level opportunities with building codes. Then we have a new and very interesting policy area emerging from air quality management districts. So these tend to be regional at the state level, but broken up by region. Air quality management districts are responsible for meeting federally mandated air quality standards. So these are the folks who are working on the plans. If they're not in attainment on those air quality standards, they have to be developing these long-term, like 10-year plans about how they're going to meet those standards and come into attainment. We're finding that a lot of AQMDs are really struggling. And so for, 20, 30 years, we've been making really dramatic air quality improvements. The power sector is improving. We're getting rid of coal. We're cleaning up power plants. Transportation sector, it's a toughie. But overall, we're on the right path as far as reducing emissions and smog-forming emissions from transportation. But again, buildings policy, it's just gone unaddressed, specifically at that fossil fuel level. And it's pretty underreported, but these fossil fuel appliances from buildings produce a huge amount of smog. In the Bay Area, where I'm from, they produce more smog than all of the passenger vehicles in the Bay Area. In California, they produce like 4 times more smog than the state's power plants. So we're talking indoor air quality, but there's also a really important outdoor air quality factor with gas-fired appliances. And so the state of California, last year, the California Air Resources Board committed to passing a zero greenhouse gas standard, or implementing one, I should say, for appliances by 2030. That would essentially end the sale of gas-fired appliances in California. And the Bay Area Air Quality Management District just took that a step further. Starting in 2027, we're going to have heat pump hot water heaters, well, basically a zero NOx standard, so no appliance can contribute to NOx pollution, from 2027 for heat pump hot water heaters and furnaces from 2030. So that's putting meat on the bones of what CARB agreed to, and any region...
So many acronyms.
I'm sorry, yes. But just noting that any region can now adopt that. There's this, most of those air quality management districts need to do best available, technology.
Yeah, and my understanding, if they're saying no NOx, no nitrogen oxides, that's essentially like its own workaround for banning gas stoves, because we don't have gas appliances that can't produce NOx, so that effectively... It means electrification.
Yes, it's a tech-neutral standard, but yes, very, very hard to burn a fossil fuel and not produce these pollutants. I will say the Bay Area version does not apply to stoves because of this outdoor-indoor issue. One thing to watch is the South Coast Air Quality Management District. That's the Southern California, covers 15 million people. I mean, it's just like... the mecca of all air quality management districts. They are potentially looking at also including stoves, but we'll just see how that goes. But they're also working on their standard. So there's a bunch of air quality regions that are out of attainment, and so we do expect that this approach might be taken in other states across the Northeast and just other places. And finally, federal policy. So obviously we have IRA, which is driving incentives towards electrification and electric appliances. There's also a petition in front of EPA. A number of groups are asking EPA to similarly pass a zero NOx appliance standards for heaters and hot water heaters. Really interestingly, and I think another important reporting angle on this is like publicly owned housing, because this is the most substandard housing often that we have in the country. A number of groups are asking HUD to pass electrification or to take steps to get these fossil fuels out of these homes as a part of whole home upgrades, where we'd be addressing, you know, mold and pests and all these other issues. And I think watching that HUD stuff is extremely interesting. The city of Boston actually just passed, I believe, a resolution to get fossil fuels out of public housing by 2030.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, and I think this is so interesting because, again, like, you know, the hope is that we can start in the places where this is of most concern. That's the smaller houses and places where pollution burdens are higher outdoors. We don't want those folks to also be subjected to such high pollution indoors. So starting in environmental justice communities and really addressing this issue of public housing, I think, is a really interesting policy space to watch.
Oh, no, I'll just, it's a great point, I think. And part of the issue, I think, with the way that so much federal policy is created and a lot of state policy too, is that one, it's really complicated to understand, but two, it's really designed for the homeowner. And so just to kind of echo this point, renters obviously have a lot less control over the appliances that are in their homes. And so these kinds of policies that can really meet the renters where they're at, and frankly mandate that landlords take certain kinds of actions, whether that's, you know, publicly owned housing, low-income housing, subsidized housing, whatever it is, I think are they're really important steps that I think can kind of work in conjunction with the sort of incentives that say, oh, buy an induction stove yourself. You know, renters are in many cities also the ones who are more exposed to outdoor air quality, outdoor air pollution, and so it's
Yeah, this is a really important point. I think this is like also not just renters, but lower income housing.
Absolutely.
This is where environmental justice also intertwines with this issue, that this is, we're talking about who is most exposed. And honestly, when you're talking about a home or people who are more exposed to that gas, the size of the home matters. Obviously, ventilation, a lot of people don't have these range hoods that would kind of vent that air outside. We also, there's huge variety of how well these range hoods work, but I am a renter with gas, so I feel this tension too of wanting to transition, but being stuck with the fact that you don't own your home. But I think portable induction, kind of the plug-in stovetops, they're sort of cheap. And I'm anecdotally hearing so much about this taking off and consumer interest in this.
Yeah, I will just say, family of four, we are renters, we have gas, we use the single Duxtop. Can I just plug Duxtop? Not paid. I just love that burner. It's like the best ever. So yeah, the portable induction, obviously a lot of people are not in a position to go retrofit their home, but if you can reduce your risk, and also we have a shit ton of electric appliances around our home, there's a lot of ways around using the gas stove if you are a renter.
Yeah, we're going to transition soon to questions, but I did want to just go down the line to give everyone a chance to kind of, this is your pitch, like what is an emerging storyline or a story you would want to see around gas stoves, or sorry, not just gas stoves, but gas in buildings and air quality.
Let's start with Darna.
Okay. Also, I hope you don't just give away your own ideas.
Right.
I feel like I sort of just said it. I think that the need to create, both the carrot and the stick here is important, and I think difficult to pay attention to when so much policy is designed as an incentive structure. And so I think that, you know, more focus on what's being done for low-income folks, more focus on what's being done for renters. Public housing, I think, is an especially sort of interesting and emerging area, is really important. I also more generally think that the new and kind of clever and impressive ways that the gas industry is adapting in light of this new research. You know, for instance, putting more focus on the need for ventilation, which I think sort of in turn serves to say, hey, actually it's your problem now, you fix it, not us. The ways that that rhetoric I think is changing and will certainly continue to change, especially as we see again more municipalities taking electrification seriously, will be a very, very fruitful, I think, source of stories.
Yeah, definitely a few thoughts that come to mind here, and in, you know, in terms of also where our research is going. I think you know, the discussion about renters and people who are most at risk also brings to mind, you know, stories that our researchers have from the field, which, you know, don't make it into the studies. They are not, you know, like the experience of every homeowner, but we certainly have multiple cases in which, you know, our researchers would, you know, slack the team and be like, oh my gosh, we can't believe we walked into this person's home today. You know, they were unaware of a gas leak. We smelt it the moment that we got to their door, right? Our monitors were going off. And one of our researchers in particular, you know, tells a story about a woman in Pennsylvania and going into her home. She was complaining of headaches and, you know, not being able to smell and could not tell that there was like a very strong gas leak. They used the instrument to kind of go around the home, and it turned out that, you know, it wasn't, didn't seem like it was getting higher at the gas stove, so there was kind of the question, like, what's, you know, leading to this leak. She was a renter, and she lived on the second floor. They went down into the basement and found that it was, the water heater was leaking, and this woman just had a poor relationship with her landlord, and so there was kind of this really significant leak happening, and it was basically like 25% of explosion risk was like the level that it was at, right? So they called, but she had been living with this for weeks, and so they ended up calling, you know, the fire department, right? And so there's kind of like, I think from our perspective, from the research perspective, there's a lot of like questions this raises. First of all, I think there's been an assumption, and this is what we will hear, especially with arguments around ventilation, which ventilation is certainly a really important tool. And, you know, I think, but the only time that anyone ventilates, if they ventilate, which is a big assumption, and it's really clear from our conversations and from research that very few people actually do it consistently, but that is, again, only for the exposure that happens when you turn the gas stove on and you are using it, right? A situation like this, or even the low-level pollution that you may not be able to smell, you're not going to be running your vent hood all day long or like with the windows open, right? It's just unrealistic. So I think that's a really, you know, the point has been around that will mitigate anything. And any other kind of leak, you will smell. And our research is really showing that actually you can have leaks that are small enough that you can't smell, but there's still exposure there. So we're still, like, a big research question we have is, what kind of concentration can build up in the house with a person with normal smell? Like, could they experience, you know, high levels of concentration? We've done some modeling that suggests, yeah, potentially, but we're doing more research in that space. And then I just say, you know, the idea that people will act in their best interest, that everyone can smell the same, that, like, that people have control over the situation, I think is another one we really want to consider and question as well around this. And then just one final point I'll make, which is, like, you know, I think there's a lot of great reasons to be looking at the home for all the reasons outlined here, but other buildings like restaurants and places where other people have, like, much greater exposure is another place to look at, right, for this. And I also think from PSC's perspective, we think about, you know, what is the true cost. We just want to have a conversation from a scientific perspective about the true cost of our energy system is broadly. And one piece of that also is, you know, when that woman, you know, when we called her fire department, they came, they shut off her gas. They also found that there was a leak at the meter. It meant that she didn't have gas for weeks, right? So we had told her, like, take a shower now. You're gonna have your gas off for weeks now. And so there's, you know, the cost to what is the true cost of the gas station, and also, like, the salary of those fire department people to come and deal with this. Yeah, so there just are risks.
And the restaurant point is really important.
Yeah.
Sage, definitely. I know you could list many stories, but I'm gonna
limit
you to one.
Ah. How about a one in three parts. Well, what did the gas industry know, and when did they know it? As far as these harms, what are they doing to prevent this
information from reaching people, and how are people reacting? We have three different class action lawsuits, Samsung, GE, LG, all that have been filed against gas stoves manufacturers in the past couple months, because people didn't have this information. They bought a gas stove, now they know, and they would like their money back. So I think we have this really growing issue about what are people going to do now that they are armed with this information, and what does it mean for manufacturers? And then I will just throw out, we're talking about appliances, but really this is about a massive energy system. We have two big energy systems, the electric system and the natural gas system. As folks are electrifying, which policy is driving, but also consumer choice is driving, we are facing a major risk of stranded assets for that gas system. And I think that that is a really interesting point, because the folks who are stuck with gas are having increasingly higher gas bills. By 2050, you could have an $8,000 monthly gas bill if you're just stuck on that. And that's a figure we just pulled from a study in New York. So as much as this is kind of about households and appliances at the micro level, at the macro level, it's really about this energy system. How are we going to strategically retire the gas system in an equitable way? We have lots of ideas and lots of new policy development on that front, but I think that's the other area that we don't want to overlook.
Yeah, I'll give my own plug, and maybe this is probably one of the things you would raise. Looking at the obstacles that have been placed in the way of building electrification, and just even the science, looking at all of these questions that Adrian was laying out, there are so many stories to tell here. There is preemption going on at the state level, where Republican-led states have been passing bans on gas bans. I think just the storyline of the influencers is so important, because I think this shows how the gas industry, they are not necessarily, they're not the trusted messenger here. So instead, we're seeing other actors step up to play that defense against the research, against the climate campaigns. So we're seeing social media influencers, we're seeing celebrity chefs, but also in this Berkeley case that just came down, actually saying that Berkeley should not have done what they did to ban gas stoves. That case was brought by the California Restaurant Association with support from the gas industry. So we're seeing these different actors step in, and that would be what my where I raise my hand on the storyline. For questions, I'm reminding attendees that this conference is created by and for journalists, so members of SEJ and other professional journalism organizations are the ones prioritized for questions, and in supporting that, please just identify yourself and remember to keep it in the form of a question. Right over here.
So I work in Minneapolis at the Star Tribune newspaper, and covering the gas transition there is really challenging because it's such a cold place, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Where it could be negative 20, negative 30 at times over the winter. So could any of you, maybe for Darna or anyone on this panel, just speak to the challenges of making this transition in really cold weather places? I'll say in Minneapolis, even the energy efficiency folks do not recommend relying on a heat pump alone right now. Mm-hmm. We're just not that one. So if anyone can speak to that.
Yeah, great. I'm just going to repeat the question for a recording, but the question was how do you talk about this transition in cold weather places when there's heat pumps and kind of conflicting information about whether gas would work, or sorry, heat pumps would work in this climate. So Darna, that would be a great question for you, given Boston.
it's a really great question, and I think honestly a really hard one, and one that it can be much easier to overlook, but that would be a bad idea. I think recently, you know, there was a cold snap in Boston in February, record-breakingly low temperatures amid a very warm overall winter, one of the warmest on record, and so, you know, people generally were not expecting it. Also, many people had already turned their heat off. And we at The Globe reached out to a number of people who had made the transition to heat pumps. Some of them really did fail. You know, you hear this sort of industry talking point that heat pumps don't work in low temperatures. Well, there's some truth to it. I mean, there are heat pumps that really do fail when the weather gets too, too cold. And so I think that first of all, just like more R&D in fixing that problem, which is already happening in, you know, places like Boston, at Harvard, at MIT, and in many other places, working to fix that problem with heat pumps, I think is really important, and I think has to kind of come part and parcel with the energy transition. You know, we need to develop the technology that will really work in all conditions. But I also think that it means encouraging people to know what they're getting into, I think, when they're making the transition. You know, I think that in climate journalism, it can be very easy to sort of tout the benefits of electrification. We should also remember that there are challenges, and that's not just, you know, that sometimes heat pumps fail. It also is that, you know, sometimes genuinely your home can become more expensive to heat if you don't have gas. You know, talking about weatherization, I think, is another really important part of this. Making sure that homes are well insulated, especially older homes, especially homes in majority in areas that are majority of color, especially low-income homes, which are often the worst insulated. And so, you know, taking all of these things as one sort of question instead of just kind of narrowly pushing for a new technology, instead of narrowly pushing for just heat pumps, I think is really the only answer.
Can I add one thing to that? I think the technology is improving. Like the state of Maine has done more per capita to move to electric heat than probably any other state, and I think is really cold, and they're having a lot of success with their policy. There's an emerging really interesting solution here that is like thermal energy networks,
yeah.
Geothermal. There's a series of pilots happening in Massachusetts. New York passed a law to start piloting this, but it's essentially like using existing or creating kind of new underground pipes to transport geothermal heat that uses air source heat pumps, but it is really tied into this city level, district level heating. Interestingly, unions are very into this idea. It's, you know, you're still building pipes and maintaining pipes, you're just pushing a different fuel through those. And I would really watch these. There's an emerging network of states where this is happening, and I think this is one really critical solution for colder climates, and it also is a great job creator, et cetera.
And the point about Maine, where heat pumps is taking off, it's definitely something you wouldn't expect. Okay, so our next question, over here.
Hi, I'm Winnie Buck. I'm a freelancer based in New York. You talked a little bit about renters and how a lot of the laws are sort of designed for homeowners. Are there laws or ordinances or parts of the way that the IRA is going to roll out that will impact renters? Because I feel like I hear a lot of people talking about how it's not, but like, is there anything that is happening that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, just to repeat that question, it's about what can we do about renters, and does the IRA affect renters in any way?
So, the straightforward tax credits that we usually talk about are more for homeowners. There's also the environmental justice block grants, though, that are being made available through IRA, and I think those can have a myriad of uses, but retrofitting community centers, getting into publicly owned housing, I think that those block grants might be one critical way we can get at renters and or environmental justice communities on this issue. That's my only addition.
Also, they are designed for homeowners, certainly, but renters can take advantage of these incentives too. Having a good relationship with your landlord is not a situation that everybody is in. But if you do, and you're in a position where you can make changes to the home that you're renting, you can take advantage of those credits too. So it is possible.
And at the broader policy level, I would just like to highlight that there are a range of orgs that are concerned at the environmental justice level and the kind of equity level about issues of displacement, because if we are encouraging landlords specifically to retrofit homes, you could see rents going up, you could see that as an excuse to evict, et cetera. I'm most familiar with this in California where I'm based, but there's a number of different tenant right protection orgs that are really looking at this, because there is certainly a way to get this policy right, and we really do want to get this right and really center to those communities, and that's another really interesting area to kind of consider. It's just this next, housing policy and energy policy, what could go wrong, right? Like, it's like this nexus of injustice in America, and so, really interesting body to study.
Yeah, thank you. Over here.
Chris DeAngelo with HuffPost. I'm glad you brought up the propane, because I live in just a macro part of Maine now, and I've switched from a lot of propane to heat pumps. But I'm wondering about what data there is on, if any, on leaks from propane appliances, specifically propane fire exits. Mm. And I realized that after months of living there, there
Yeah, great question. So talk more about propane, specifically propane leaks, and if this propane fireplaces, if this is a particular issue.
Yeah, so I'll say for propane, I think there's been significantly less research. And I do think it's really important, especially when we get into this kind of resilience discussion, because like my family lives in California with, you know, and so like that's what they use, and when the grid goes out, right, there's kind of this argument around that being more resilient. I think, so there's been less research. We are currently looking at that and should have research in the near future that includes propane. One thing I'll just say in terms of other appliances in your home and gas fireplaces are one, right? One of the key distinctions that's important to remember with our gas stoves are that, you know, they don't vent outside, and a gas fireplace should. But to the same point, you know, this is one of those questions where, like, if it has a pilot light that's burning all the time, is that enough, right? Does the vent just turn on when you turn on your fireplace? And so, all to say, no, there isn't really clear research on that. We'd have to look at it.
I'll just turn them off.
There you go. All right.
I'll say too, I guess, that there is, I'm sure, also in Maine and Massachusetts, there's. Look, I would highly recommend looking at the lawsuits. The regulatory framework for propane is pretty old, and that creates problems, I think. And so, you know, there's a lot more research to be done. There's also some sort of legal action happening currently that I think is worth digging into.
Great. I think I saw it before. Do you still have a question? Oh, no, sorry, right over here.
Reed Fraser, Allegheny Front, Pittsburgh Radio. So I may have missed this, and I apologize if I did, but is there any sense that there might be some indoor air regulations, particularly for people living in, you know, public housing? I have a follow-up, but.
Okay, yeah, the question was indoor air regulations for people in public housing.
Or sort of anywhere.
Or, yeah, are indoor air regulations coming?
I mean, I think a proposal was put forward a couple decades ago to amend the Clean Air Act to address indoor air. It didn't go anywhere, and I'm not fully clear on why. To be honest, not sure. So we have the Consumer Product Safety Commission. What they're doing right now is this request for information on gas stove pollution. That in no way changes the jurisdiction and the rules, but at least we might be getting at some kind of standards on gas stoves that might limit those indoor pollution. But as Adrian's been bringing up, we have these really hella leaky other appliances that are vented outdoors, but all the gas that's leaking from them are coming indoors. Given, you know, the dumpster fire that is the U.S. Congress, I just don't know that there's a possibility of getting strong standards through or creating kind of new regulatory pathways. But,
I was going to follow up. Is California, for example, looking at this, though? Because you see this at a state level.
Right. So the California Air Resources Board has passed a resolution that notes the issue. I don't believe that it's their view that they can do that much, although it is possible that, again, it wouldn't be through air quality standards, but it is possible that when the time comes to implement this zero greenhouse gas emission standard for heaters and hot water heaters, we extend that to appliances that are inside the home, but I can't say that much about that because that's 4 years away as far as development goes. But again, that wouldn't be addressing this core problem that no one regulates indoor air quality.
In the back?
And my name is Hal Burton. I'm a journalist based in Portland. I used to work for Seattle Times recently. I had one question. I have my son and his wife, and they have a new gas stove, young child. And I was just thinking, like, is there a way that we could go in with some sort of equipment or something to figure out, okay, in this particular place, what is the risk? You know, how bad is it? your, as you guys do your research, I know it's not going to be as good, but something to give people a ballpark so they can take things into their own hands if they care. You know, they don't have to wait for a regulation, figure out the risk, and you're talking about the plugins. Is that even possible?
So the question is there like equipment or monitoring that people can have to at least just see if this is a problem in their own home?
Yeah, we get that question a lot. And I would say that, you know, we always advise people if you are worried about a leak, right? This is a brand new gas stove, so maybe you are, or maybe you aren't, but if you are worried about a leak, you should call your gas utility, and they will come and check it, right? But again, they're looking for like explosive risk. And what we found is that, you know, gas stoves can leak at a much lower level. So what I would say is there doesn't seem to be a good kind of like off the, you know, something you can order on Amazon or like go to the, you know, to the hardware store and get like a little monitor. There's not a good solution for that will capture that is accurate enough. I know that there, we get this question a lot, and to my knowledge, there's not a really good solution like that. You know, we have monitors that are quite expensive, but we are interested in, and I think that, happy to kind of follow up about this, we are really interested in the idea of kind of citizen science on this. And so I know we're exploring kind of like how would we approach that and how would we engage the public to do this science and share what they're finding. But I think it does require, you know, being able to get accurate measurements.
And just to confirm, like outside of you, there's not some network of private contractors that you could call up and say, well, hey, come in and do this assessment?
Not that I'm aware of.
There are more kind of citizen science groups, and yeah. I'm not sure, I'll be honest, about what's happening in Seattle, but there are more people working on this. I actually had it was a advocacy group that does have some of these sensitive equipment come to my home, because I mentioned I have gas, to measure NO2 levels. And also they detected if there was actually a methane leak, and fortunately they said no. But so it is limited. I would just add that I think there's a misconception. Carbon monoxide detectors and your air filters are not necessarily getting all of these pollutants. And carbon monoxide detectors specifically are not necessarily capturing that lower level emissions of CO that might still be coming from the stove. They're monitoring a much higher level. So I think there's a lot of confusion around this. And Sage, I think you had a...
I was just gonna say, I totally understand the question. It's maybe a budding industry of folks who could go in and assess risk, but like, what kind of a situation are we in when individuals are expected to try and understand and determine their level of risk on this issue and then develop their own solutions? I mean, this is exactly why we're pushing for local, state, federal solutions here, because this is a policy problem. This really should not be an individual problem. And no critique on the question, but just in general, I think it kind of shines a light on why we so urgently need standards for stoves, but also just to really address this issue of fossil fuels in homes.
So we have a chance for one last question. You were raising your hand earlier.
Yeah. This might actually dovetail on the last question, but is there any nexus here with the EPA push for hyper-local community air monitoring? You mentioned the EPA grants, but I just wonder if there's an opportunity here, either maybe not to inform potential regulatory like changes here, but even just to better educate the public about their risk, which I think is very low bar.
Yeah, this is, I think, about public education, and I think this is a great chance to talk about the Illinois initiative to label gas stoves as dangerous.
Yeah, so we have the nation's first bill to put a warning label on gas stoves working its way through the Illinois legislature right now. If I was both the gas industry and stove manufacturers, I would be very much in favor of this kind of policy, again, just because we're starting to see these class action lawsuits against manufacturers. Also, this idea of a warning label or more direct public education is certainly one of the things that we think it's likely that the CPSC will come back with after this RFI. That RFI public comment period actually wraps up next month, and so, you know, they'll look at the data. We're not sure what next steps are, but warning labels, more public education is really likely. And beyond that, I think, you know, this is one reason why
researchers continue to study the issue, and the whole climate, public health, and environmental justice movement really wants to push it forward, is we really do just want to arm people with knowledge right now so that they can mitigate their risk. And there is a lot you can do in an individual home, again, whether it's using a plug-in burner, just turning to some other electric appliances. One other point, the American Medical Association, the American Public Health Association, just within the past couple years, these major public health bodies have passed resolutions, you know, noting the public health dangers of gas stoves and gas appliances, and also committing to doing more public awareness. And I think that could be really interesting if we start having, which a lot of doctors and a lot of in-home care workers who work on asthma, already this is one of the first things they recommend for childhood asthma, et cetera. But I do think the more that we see the health community get involved here, and that really trusted source of information be given to folks, that will be at least one step forward as far as access to information and then mitigating your personal risk.
Great. Sorry, we have to cut off the questions there because we're out of time. You're hearing probably applause from other panels. Thank you so much for these thoughtful questions, and to our panelists for this incredibly thorough discussion about the complicated and very fast evolving landscape. So I appreciate it, and thank you for your attendance.